explain this effect in relativistic quantum mechanics. So this is outline. First, I'll speak about textbook stuff, how decay dilation is described in special relativity. Then some words about relativistic quantum mechanics, decay law of particles at rest. So these three subjects, it's just textbook stuff. Just want to set up conditions for my description of decay law of moving particles, and finally some discussion. Okay, let's try to remember special relativity. Suppose we have a particle which is decaying. Decay law is normally exponential. So this is time. On the vertical axis, it's probability of finding the particle, which is given by this exponent. At time zero, particle is created with probability one, and then probability goes down exponentially. Now, the question is how moving observer will see the same unstable particle. To find that out, we should define two events in particle life. Let's say one event is preparation of the particle, which occurs at position zero and time zero. And another event, for example, it's time when time 1 over gamma, when probability is 1 over e. So that's space-time coordinates of these events. So now we look at the same picture from the point of view of moving observer. And I introduce here parameter rapidity, theta, which is quite convenient. And that's velocity v is related to theta by this formula. And we just apply to our two events standard Lorentz transformations, which are given here, and we obtain coordinates of the same two events in the moving reference frame. Okay, it's all very simple. And what we notice is that these two events now have time coordinate zero, and second event is 1 over gamma cos theta. So what we found that time separation between these two events, which are now shown by green points, from the point of view of moving observer is longer than for observer at rest. And the slowdown of decay is given by this expression cos theta. And the decay law of moving particle is given exactly by this formula. Okay. So we see that in special relativity, there is universal slowdown of the decay law. And this formula doesn't depend on anything but what kind of particle, what is the nature of interaction leading to the decay, and so on.
Since you want to make a very interesting point, let me understand something. So in an actual experiment, that time scale would be given. Like, I should have a bunch of particles, right? And then I have to check at any time how many decays.
Yes. Yes. So, that's my next slide. Oh, little bit.
Yeah.
So the most accurate and comprehensive experiment which checks this formula was made, I think, in 1977, when they stored muons in cyclotron, and the velocity, relativistic factor was about 30. So it means that speed was so high that decay rate was 30 times slower for these muons. And they were able, if you need references, I can pretty easily find it out. They were able to check this relativistic formula to the accuracy of 0.1%. That's the best result we have. There are some other measurements with not so good accuracy, but they all agree that this formula works with pretty good precision. Yes, they have store, I don't know, large number of muons in this ring, and they follow what the rate with which the number of muons decreases in the bunch. I don't know exact details of the experiment, but that's the idea. So we have theory and experiment. They agree with each other to, I don't know, good precision. So what else we need? Let's just ask this question, that decay is a typical quantum process. So if we want to describe decay, we need to apply relativistic quantum mechanics. And in principle, we should be able, in quantum mechanics, also describe decay from the point of view of two different observers and find out from this approach what is the difference of the two decay laws. The question is, shall we obtain the same results as we got from special relativity? That would be, yeah.
Can I just ask a question? If the discussion of the quantum mechanical process of decay is entirely Lorentz covariant, how can it lead to anything other than the usual time dilation law?
That's the purpose of my talk. We'll discuss it at the end. Yeah, that's the question I'll try to answer. So now we switch to relativistic quantum mechanics. What do I mean by that? The fundamental paper is written by Wigner in 1939, and his main conclusion is that Hilbert space of any quantum relativistic system must carry a unitary representation of the Poincaré group. And there are number of elementary inertial transformations which we have in the Poincaré group, like time translations, space translations, rotations, and boosts. And all of them are represented by unitary operators like these. And there are each of these classes of transformation have their generator. And generators are represented by Hermitian operators, which are identified in this theory with total observables of the system. These generators are total energy, or Hamiltonian, operator of total momentum, angular momentum, and this boost operator, which is related to center of energy. And the generators of the Poincaré group must satisfy commutation relations of the Poincaré-Lie algebra. And here I just put some of these commutators. There are a little bit more than that. Yeah, that's the basic outline of Wigner's theory. He also classified, he also postulated that elementary systems should be represented or described by irreducible unitary representations of the Poincaré group. He gave classification of all the representations and found that they are characterized by parameters mass, which is greater or equal to zero for physical particles, and spin, which takes half integer values. Now, the same theory can be extended to n particle systems. The only difference is that the Hilbert space now is constructed as a tensor product of one particle spaces. And the next question we need to ask, which representation of the Poincaré group should we use in this Hilbert space? One simple choice is just build a representation as a tensor product of irreducible representations. And this representation plays special role. I'll define it generators with suffix zero. And it's easy to show that this particular choice of representation corresponds to n non-interacting particles. It should
so
be.
So the picture is every particle just gets transformed independently.
Yes.
Of each other.
Each particle lives independently on others. It moves without knowing of existing of other particles.
We may have a symmetric tensor product.
Yes, if particles are identical, we need to properly symmetrize, anti-symmetrize. Yes, that's right. Now, what about interacting systems? And this has been done by Dirac in 1949. So he tried to classify different ways by which you can introduce representation of the Poincaré group in this n-particle Hilbert space. And he called them forms of dynamics. So since a representation is basically defined by its generators, so what we need is to build 10 Hermitian operators in our Hilbert space, which will satisfy Poincaré commutation relations. And yes, and there are several forms of dynamics which he considered, like, for instance, general form, where all generators, H, P, J, K, are different from non-interacting generators. It's the most general form. But there are also some specific forms, like instant form of dynamics, generators of space, translations, and rotations as the same as non-interacting representation. But Hamiltonian and boost operator, they get some corrections which depend on interaction. It's V and Z. Now, there is also point form of dynamics in which boost and rotation are interaction free, and Hamiltonian and total momentum get interactions. There are also other forms like front form, but it's quite complicated. It doesn't fit into this table. But that's the basic idea, the classification. That's important point, that you cannot have a form of dynamics in which space translation, rotation, and boosts are interaction-free, and only Hamiltonian has interaction. That's forbidden because you will violate Poincaré commutation relations. That's important thing. Now, which of these form of dynamics is actually realized in nature? That's an interesting question. We'll probably touch it a little bit. But so far, we'll use the instant form of dynamics. I have my reasons for doing that, but that's a little bit different story. So let's use instant form of dynamics in which interaction is present in the Hamiltonian and in the boost operator. Now, the same theory can be extended even further to systems where number of particles is not fixed. So it's only different that instead of like fixed tensor product space, we define Fock space in which any number of particles can be present, like zero particles, one particles, two particles, and so on. And if we want to define interacting dynamics, we need to define a representation of the Poincaré group in this Fock space. And depending on how we define this representation, we'll give different types of interactions between particles. And the trick is to find representation which fits nature. That's a difficult problem, but we're moving toward that. And interacting representation of the Poincaré group here in the Fock space, in principle, can cross borders between different sectors. So sectors are not necessarily invariant with respect to Poincaré group. So it means that particles can be created, annihilated, and that's what we need to describe decays. Okay, that was something about relativistic quantum mechanics. Now we go to decay law of particles at rest. So how would describe decay of particle A into particle B plus C at rest for the beginning? We are not interested now in the whole Fock space. The only relevant parts are subspace of particle A and subspace of two particles, B and C. And here I try to represent this Hilbert space in some schematic form. I use like one dimension to describe HA, subspace of particle A, and two dimensions for the decay products. Unfortunately, I don't have many dimensions here. So these two subspaces, they are orthogonal. Now, initial state, of course, we need to prepare our particle so that its state vector lies entirely in subspace HA, because that's our definition of particle A. And since particle is at rest, we choose its state vector to be eigenvector of momentum with value 0. Or we can use, of course, some wave packet, but it's not important. And then we just apply, in order to find what occurs at next time, at time t, we just apply time evolution operator. So our state vector at time t is time evolution operator acting on the initial state vector. So state vector will follow some trajectory in the Hilbert space with time. And at certain time, it will have some projection on both subspace HA and also on the subspace on decay products. So this means that the probability of finding particle A should be calculated by this formula. It is just the norm of the projection on subspace HA, where T is just projection operator on HA. And one particular form could be like this in momentum representation. So that's how we describe decay.
Do you think there may be subtleties in choosing B equals 0? Because, so you want to characterize an event, and an event should be associated to a localized particle which at some point decays. These are how I see it. Now, strictly, if I put B equals 0, this particle is everywhere.
Yes.
So,
but
then you make a transformation, but.
In principle, you can choose some localized wave packet, which is approximately at some point and has momentum which is close to zero. It wouldn't change much results. No, one can show that. So that's a general setup. Now, how we can do practical calculations? So in practical calculations, it would be convenient to consider a set of eigenvectors of the Hamiltonian which I denote E here with eigenvalues, also E, and decompose our initial state function into these bases. And mu of E are expansion coefficients. Now, it was shown by Breit and Wigner, I think sometimes in 1930s, that it's quite important result, that if interaction, which leads to decay, interaction in H, is sufficiently small, weak, then this function has, actually, its square, its modulus, has almost universal form. So for weak interactions, you'll always get this Lorentzian form, which is called Breit-Wigner resonance. And it looks like, okay, you know how it looks like. This Breit-Wigner resonance is normally centered around mass of particle A, oh, rest energy of particle A. The function is zero below threshold, where is the sum of rest energies of decay products. And it has a width, which is width gamma. Now, in order to calculate decay probability by formula from the next slide, or from previous slide, if we put everything there, what we get is this integral for the decay probability, which is easy to show that it's approximately exponent. So we got exponential decay law in consistency with experiment, so looks good. But that's at rest.
So is this the same shape that you would find accelerators in experiments?
Yes.
When they see the
yes.
resonance?
That's universal shape, yeah.
Precisely that?
Yes.
It's picked on the, so when they say that the tau has got mass such and such?
Yes, 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 yes. It's Breit-Wigner resonance, which you can find everywhere, in atomic physics, in nuclear physics. So all, practically all unstable systems will behave in this way. There would be some deviations when interaction is strong. It means when this gamma, normally this gamma is much smaller than mass of the particle. That's what I mean, that interaction is weak. But like for strongly decaying resonances, it becomes comparable with mass of the particle. So probably for these resonances, decay law is not exponential, but their lifetime is 10 to the minus 23 seconds, so nobody can measure the decay law. So it is well-known fact that whichever unstable system you take, you always measure exponential decay law. There are theoretical works which prove that real decay law cannot be exponential, that there always should be some small deviation at near time zero, some deviation at long times, but they are so small that it's very difficult to observe them.
Can I just ask a question? This is this coefficient of the energy eigenstate is defined at t is equal to zero.
Is defined at
when it's defined when the state of the system is entirely in the HA.
Yes. State. So it is. I'll take state with zero momentum and expand it in.
Right. This is at the initial time and when the.
But at time at other time, this coefficient will be multiplied by exponent e.
E.
Yeah. By this exponent.
Zero. Of course, the formula doesn't contain any mention of MB and MC because the state is outside of that subspace.
Yes, but our full Hamiltonian, it does know about existence of B and C.
Right, but at the original time, NB and MC don't appear in the coefficient.
Mm. Well, you actually take mu E of that form, but down to NB plus MC, right?
Yes,
and this is why,
because
it's
here this integral actually goes from this value here, because we don't have any states with energy below this energy, right? Up to infinity, I didn't put this integration limits here. But even at time zero, we have some information about presence of particles B and C, simply as a limit of energy in this integral. Because MB plus MC C square, that's our bottom of our energy spectrum. Of course, this formula, yeah, all right. Did I answer?
I'll come back.
Okay, well, that was the decay law of particle at rest. So everything so far was pretty standard stuff, which you can find in articles and textbooks. Now we'll switch to something new, which is decay law of moving particles. Now, here I reproduce this formula for decay law at rest, just for comparison. Another question, how are we going to apply the same theory to moving particles? And it should be simple. Just instead of initial state vector with zero momentum, we take initial state vector with non-zero momentum. For example, we can take momentum given by this. Just I use this expression just to use parameter theta for convenience. And this state with non-zero momentum can be obtained by applying boost operator, non-interacting boost operator, to the state with zero momentum. This initial state still lies completely inside HA, so we still have particle A with non-zero momentum, nothing else. And in order to get state vector at time t, we apply the same Hamiltonian, the same time evolution operator with interacting Hamiltonian. And then substitute all this stuff in our original formula for the probability of finding particle A.
Why is the Hamiltonian the same?
We don't have any boost. We have actually here.
You're looking at from a new frame,
yeah. Yes, I'll talk about it a bit later. But currently, we are still in the reference frame at rest. But instead of particle at rest, we are looking at decay of moving particle.
But even so, the Hamiltonian is not necessarily invariant.
It's the same Hamiltonian. It should be described for a given observer. There should be one Hamiltonian which describes everything happens to this observer. Why should it change?
I'm not sure that's true. It's not the case in the Galilean.
Well, Hamiltonian can change. One observer may have one Hamiltonian, another observer another Hamiltonian. That's true. But if I am observer, I have all my measuring apparatuses and operators of observables. I have fixed Hamiltonian which describe everything I want to know about the system, independent of what state of the system I'm looking at. So I take the standard formula, gives me this expression, and if I just do the calculation, I end up with this integral. So the difference is that here, instead of E for the particle at rest, I have this square root here. And the amazing part is that if you calculate this integral, you cannot probably do it analytically, but numerically, you will see that it doesn't agree with our expectation from special relativity. So that's special relativistic results. So it means that decay law of moving particle does not follow the same time dilation formula as we expected from special relativity.
Again, here, I mean, the fact that the particle has zero momenta is should be influent, because it mean it really means that it's everywhere. So whenever I boost, yeah, of course whenever I boost, I'm in a frame in which there the particle is already decayed a little bit. But this is just because the particle is completely spread.
Okay, we'll probably discuss. There will be a slide where I'll try to ask question what's wrong with this. Probably will. That's one of possibilities, but I think it can be ruled out. So there is apparently something wrong somewhere. Now, if you calculate this particular integral and try to compare it with time dilation formula, that's what you get. So I grossly exaggerated the effect, but that's the general picture. So broken line is original decay law at rest. This gray line is what you would expect from time dilation formula. And the full line is what you get from quantum mechanical calculation. Okay, this is exaggerated just to give you sense of what's it about. But I also did some numerical calculations by this formula using Mathematica. And that's what I got. What's the deviation from special relativistic results given by quantum mechanical formula? Now I need to spend some time to explain how I arranged this graph. So this thick line is a normal exponential decay law at rest. This chi is time measured in units of particle lifetime. So it's 6 lifetimes. Now, if I wanted to plot here decay laws for moving particles, since they delayed, so they would be somewhere far on this graph. So in order to put them all together, I scaled each of these decay laws of moving particles by relativistic factor. So I just squeezed them all together. And if special relativistic result is correct, then all of them will fit exactly on this thick line. Okay? So they're just scaled by factor cos theta. But decay laws computed by the formula I showed, they don't fall on this line, and they show some deviation which is given by these graphs. So I calculated this deviation for 3 values of parameter theta, like 10, 1.4, 0.2, and that's what you see here. Now, the absolute value of deviation, you can see it's like 0.2%. Actually, percentage-wise, it's even higher here. But it looks like this value is consistent with, is the same as accuracy of experimental measurements. So the question is, can we measure these deviations? But the answer is no, because you can notice which kind of system I used for these calculations. I used parameters mass of particle A, like 1,000 mega electron volts, B plus C, 900, and decay width gamma to 20 MeV. So that's not any real particle, but it's these numbers characteristics for strongly decaying resonances. So the particle I'm looking at here is decaying in time. So the unit of time here is about 10 to the minus 3 seconds. So there is no chance to detect this kind of effect. So the question is, what would be corrections for more accessible particles like neutron or muons? And the answer is, if numerical calculations become quite difficult due to this constellation of big numbers, which produce a small one. But anyway, estimation shows that the size of effect for muons, for instance, is like 10 to the minus 18th. So it's completely beyond the capabilities of modern experiment. What is small, sorry?
What the real behavior of the decay when k is very small? Do you remember? If you look at the, when k is very small.
K?
Oh,
this one. Mm-hmm. So this is a time in units of lifetime. If it is small, if it is here.
Is it like
No, actually, I didn't calculate it so precisely. I just took a number of points and then just smoothed them out. Yeah, another thing here also, I probably wouldn't speculate about that. What is the behavior of all this? This correction goes to zero. At zero chi?
No,
the decay law, whether it's exponential or it's not exponential at time zero, that's in this particular calculation, it was exponential, but general result doesn't. I'll have a slide about that. So that's another thing, like question, what can be wrong with that? Just keep it in mind. We'll have a slide about that.
Also asking, is there a simple rule for the scale that you are plotting there? So let's say in your case, for theta equal 10, you have point 0.1%
or
10 to the minus 3.
Mm-hmm.
What fixes
that
number?
There is a work where people, I'll mention it later, that's not me alone who found this thing. There are some people who also noticed that. And there are some analytical results, approximate analytical results. I just did numerical calculations.
The scale should be given by the masses and
the gram. What is the, can I reformulate the question? What is the smallness parameter here which controls the size of the effect?
Yeah. Yeah.
I think it is a ratio of gamma to the particle mass. So if you have strongly decaying resonances with large gamma, with large decay width, which is comparable to the mass of the particle, you get large effect. Like I showed here, this ratio is 20 to 1,000. But in the case of muons, this ratio is many orders of magnitude less. And so the effect is also many orders of magnitude less. So for slowly decaying particles, this effect is small. For fast decaying particles, it's large, but it's difficult to see because for fast decaying particles, their lifetime is so short that we just cannot see this effect.
Is it not the Zener effect?
What?
Is it not the Zener effect?
Zener effect is something different. It's a different story about. Yes. But it's these results. I'll mention later, but these results were obtained in the supposition of exponential decay, but one can show that it's not important. The same qualitatively, the same results can be obtained for any other type of decay, any other type form of this function mu. So we reached some interesting conclusion here, that Einstein's time dilation formula is not accurate description of the decay of moving particles. So there is a non-equality sign here. And also the time dilation is not universal, but depends on the strength of interaction causing the decay. So this is really disturbing, as you understand. So as you said, we used relativistically invariant theory, and we obtained results disagreeing with special relativity. So something is going on here. So now we switch to discussion. So what could go wrong? So maybe there is just error in calculations, right? But it doesn't seem likely because there are three independence checks of these results. If you're interested, I can give references by Halfin, Shirokov. Or the calculations are very simple, so there is no place to hide for some subtlety. Now, another question that we have calculated decay law of moving particle rather than decay law of a particle viewed from a moving reference frame, right? Because special relativity allows us to compare results of measurements in two different reference frames. But here we cheated a little bit, right? We use one reference frame and two different particles. The question is, what's the difference? Actually, there is a subtle difference between these two situations, but there is a paper. Numerical quantum mechanical results are very close for realistic systems. And I can give an argument which shows that even in the case of two relatively moving reference frames, we will never obtain exact Einstein's time dilation formula. So in the instant form of dynamics, time dilation formula cannot be exactly reproduced. Now, the proof is very short. Suppose that this formula is true, right? So decay law, decay probability at time zero in a moving reference frame, according to this formula, should be the same as in the reference frame at rest. It should be one, right? Now, in quantum mechanics, this means that the subspace of unstable particle is invariant with respect to boosts. So we're looking at the particle from one reference frame and see that probability is one. And looking at it from moving reference frame, it means that we apply boost transformation to the description of the particle. And since probability doesn't change, particle state vector doesn't leave the subspace HA. It means that this subspace is invariant with respect to boosts. Here, notice that I used interacting boost operator because that's what we need to use when we transform from one observer to another. Now, from this equality, we simply use Jacobi identity and calculate. Remember, T is a projector on HA. Calculate commutator of Hamiltonian with this projector. And according to one of Poincaré Lie algebra commutators, H can be expressed as commutator of momentum and boost. Then we apply Jacobi identity. Since boost commuting with t according to our assumption, and also translation is commuting with t because it doesn't contain any interaction translation. So everything is zero. This means that subspace HA is invariant with respect to time translation, so there is no decays. So we reached this absurd proposition. Therefore, even if we consider description of decay from different reference frames, we will not get agreement with time dilation formula. Now, what else could be wrong there?
Can I just ask a question there?
Yeah.
Is this partly because if we do a Lorentz transformation, relativity of simultaneity means looking at a different hypersurface of space-time. Now, if you think of the original wave function and you rewrite it on this new hyperplane, you're picking up future parts of the wave function and past parts of the wave function.
Mm-hmm.
So therefore, you've got to pick up something that has to do with decay. So that condition is ruling that out.
You
can't decay at all.
Yes, but there is all our calculations there. We didn't even touch what the form of wave function. So it's all algebraical, and I would also like probably postpone discussion of explanation of what's here goes wrong until tomorrow. I'll have another talk where I try to explain my vision of what's wrong here. And we'll probably have discussion about that as well. But it doesn't seem likely to me that we miss some non-simultaneity in wave functions. Because we never, in this derivation, if you follow it, the form of wave function never comes out. So we don't care what it is.
But it's independent of the form of the wave function. It's just that because of the relativity of simultaneity, whatever the wave function is,
mm-hmm.
it's going to pick up when you transform it to another hypersurface.
Mm-hmm.
It will pick up a dynamical element
mm-hmm.
with respect to the first frame.
Okay.
You know what the dynamic is. This should be now. If I construct a wave packet which is very localized, this makes sense.
Well, but if it's very localized in one frame, it's not going to be very localized in another.
Can we postpone this discussion until tomorrow?
No, because it's very interesting, yeah. But it depends what you're looking at.
Because I have my view on that, and I wanted to present it in the talk tomorrow. And if I start to, it would be confusing if I'll start to give you my answer today. Okay? And don't want to be disrespectful, but simply it would be easier for me to discuss these things tomorrow. I'll introduce some new concepts and stuff.
But I just want to understand what you're saying in the slide. You're saying that if you assume the relativistic transformation.
Yes, this is what we got from time dilation formula, from special relativity.
And furthermore, you're assuming that you're using a boost generator that's associated with interactions.
Yes.
Then you conclude that there can be no decay.
Yes. So this equation is just follows from that assumption, from this formula.
So otherwise stated, equivalent probably, which is if I can build a state of my unstable particle traveling with some velocity, and this is a state.
No, in this particular case, that's different.
Yeah,
that's
two different
approaches.
Yeah. So,
mm-hmm.
so the state that I construct by making my unstable particle going at some velocity is different from the state that I construct by taking my stable particle, which is at rest, and just boosting it. Because the boosting
the
products of the...
It would be different. The difference is in this situation. One situation, you are observer at rest, and there is a particle, and you give this particle some speed. So it remains the same particle, just moving with certain speed. That's one situation. Another one, you have the same particle viewed by two different observers, one at rest, one is moving. So the point here, so that in this case, moving observer doesn't see unstable particle exactly with probability one. So if observer is moving, the probability is changing.
So we see also the decay products are
Yes. He will see some admixture of decay products. And that's what is proven here. That's, of course, it's a little bit weird, yes. But that's what follows from theory.
That's not surprising.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Now, what else could be wrong? We used Dirac's instant form of dynamics. Perhaps there are other forms which give better results agreeing with special relativity. And the answer is no. For example, one can explore the same technique in the point form of dynamics, and one can find, amazingly, that in this form of dynamics, instead of slowing down, decay of particles, of moving particles accelerates. Like Korsch times becomes faster in complete disagreement with all we know about special relativity and experiment. So the answer is no. Any other form of dynamics will not save you. It will make things even worse. So instant form of dynamics, in some sense, the most closely corresponding to experiment. Now, another point which I mentioned, that I used the exponential decay law, but it's only for presentation purposes. In principle, we could use any shape of this function and still get qualitatively the same results. So the question, I would like to leave you with this question. Could it be that special relativity is valid only approximately? And I'll try to answer it tomorrow. We'll see.
Can I ask a question about
yes.
the Dirac form that is 1949?
Yeah.
Does it follow from his assumptions that the boost is a unitary operator?
Yeah, all the operators are unitary, that's
right. That doesn't hold in the case of the direct wave function. Direct wave, the boost on the direct wave function is not unitary.
That's probably true, but I avoided using Dirac equation, Dirac wave function here. I stick to Wigner type presentation of relativistic quantum mechanics.
I'm just curious how general this is, because I think it's worth bearing in mind that in the case of one known relativism.
But that should be, then something is wrong with the Dirac's wave function.
No.
It cannot
be. It's not a compact group. The boosts are not compact, so you cannot have a finite dimension.
But you should have preservation of probabilities. If it's unitary.
You don't define the probabilities by way of psi square.
I don't think this, I think this is independent.
That's different, I would say, branches of relativistic quantum theory. One is like Dirac branch. Started from his Dirac equation. And this one is Wigner. And they are not exactly the same. There is some correspondence. And I would prefer to stick to Wigner 39, Dirac 49 presentation. We can discuss how this relates to Dirac equation. But it's completely different story. I have my ideas about that.
So I think this is slightly different because when you have this problem with Dirac, you are talking about your four-dimensional finer space, but just strictly four dimensional. Well, here you are in the space of the field, so you have an infinite, infinite dimension, and these are real operators that act in the space of the field.
There's another issue here. When you derive the time dilation formula in special relativity, you have to assume, first of all, that the moving object is a clock. I mean, it may well be that you have an object that's arrested as a clock. But if you have to assume that the object, when boosted, remains a clock.
The assumption made here that this probability omega, it doesn't depend on which reference frame you look at it.
Well,
so
that's what I'm wondering, because I mean, how do I know a priori?
That's usual assumption people make. And actually, in my, if you remember this short proof, I tried to prove that it's not the case. So if you look at particle, even at time zero, from the moving reference frame, this full line should not go exactly to one, but be somewhere lower than one. In the moving reference frame, particle has some chance to be in the form of decay products. That's what follows from quantum mechanics. But usual textbooks, the derivation of special relativity, just assume, without much talking about that, that omega is the same, it's like scalar. You look at it from different reference frame, it's the same. So I see I a little bit confused you.
Time dilation is defined with respect to clocks. Now, and you're assuming that if a clock, a good clock that's at rest with respect to the original, will remain a good clock. But it's boosted with respect to the new rest frame. That's an absolutely essential assumption in deriving the time dilation. Now, is it obvious that it applies in this case?
Yes, there's some.
In some sense, it's a decaying particle of clock at all.
Now, we, of course, in order to measure decay, we need to have some clock in each reference frame, right? We need to have something on the wall or on our wrist, and some stable clock, which is supposed to be identical in moving reference frame and the reference frame at rest. I don't want this notion that clock is boosted from one frame to another. I would better prefer thinking that we at rest have our built our atomic clock somewhere with high precision clock. And somebody flying in a rocket also built his own atomic clock from the same ingredients by the same blueprint. And this would guarantee that both clocks work identically. So the time he measured by his clock in his reference frame is exactly the same as time we measure here. So would it answer your question? So then we should be certain that two observers measure, have the same meaning of time in their respective reference frames. Of course, if you want to boost, take atomic clock and boost it to high velocities, I don't know what happens there. It may just break.
So there are like two aspects of special relativity that here seem to be in conflict.
Mm-hmm.
So there is the aspect of Lorentz transformation, which is just the transformation of the point events,
yes,
space time. And there is the aspect of the group theoretical aspect
yes.
Of the transformation.
That's exactly my talk for Thursday. That's the title of talk, Lorentz transformations in relativistic quantum theory, something like that. So I will discuss how can we derive these transformations in relativistic quantum theory, interacting quantum theory, with full interacting Hamiltonian, or not. And I.
Yeah, Yeah, but because you want to save the group theoretical structures of your...
I want to save group theoretical structure. I can sacrifice even this, but I want to save group theoretical structure because it's, in my opinion, that's the most important part in relativity. Because inertial transformation should form a group. One way or another, it should be a group. Like, successful application of transformation should give us another transformation. So if it's not group, then all relativity is lost, in my opinion. The group must be Poincaré group. It's confirmed by everything we know. That cannot be avoided.
But you're asking, sorry, I mean, I can't see how you're questioning whether or not those Lorentz transformations are valid.
Mm-hmm.
Well, what do they mean? They're telling you how to transform coordinate labels to certain pairs of events.
Mm-hmm.
Now, those events are well defined in the space time, localized events.
Yes.
Right. Given that everything, given the construction, as you were mentioning before, all of your clocks, you have your best atomic clocks, all of the fundamental physics behind the construction of those clocks is Lorentz covariant. It's impossible for me to understand how those equations could be false. It just follows from the Lorentz covariance of all the fundamental interactions. But another much more non-trivial question is, what happens when we have decaying bodies? We introduce intrinsic probabilities. Then the question of what transformation of the probabilities mean, what do you mean by the events? Coming back to Federico's point, where are the localized events in this theory? I mean, one can see all kinds of complications arising, but not that the Lorentz transformations.
That would be exactly the subject. This would be
the construction, the vertical construction of Einstein is all made like something that goes to a classical picture, no? There was also air trains coming, light flash that bounce on my mirror, etc. I think there is a classical construction in the sense that I have a four-dimensional space time, and the event is a point in four-dimensional space time. Maybe. What he's saying is related to the fact that this is the way I see it, at least. This construction is approximate. Is approximate. I don't know.
No, but this is the bit, I mean, Lorentz covariance is the basis of all of our Lagrangians in quantum field theory.
That's right.
I mean, I cannot see how you can avoid it.
That's why it's so scary.
No, are you saying it's more than a question that's related to the Lorentz transformation?
Let me talk about that tomorrow, because I would like to proceed gradually to answer this question. Don't miss tomorrow talk, and we'll discuss it.
Because if you're going to question, that is what I'm missing. So let's.
To where?
If you're going to question a Lorentz transformation, he's going to miss your talk tomorrow. So
oh.
Let's just say.
What time is the talk tomorrow?
At 4. Which result?
I mean, is the result obtained here the same as that obtained in quantum field theory?
In quantum?
Your approach is.
No, this is special relativity, yeah.
Yeah, but I want to ask the K law is same as that can be quantum field.
In quantum field theory. But this is, we take just portion of Fock space. We don't need to explore entire Fock space because the problem is very simple. The beauty of this problem, it's very simple. It's the simplest like interacting system you can imagine. One particle decays into two, and it's almost analytically solvable. And I would say that it's the same would hold in quantum field theory. What we did, we just took some portion of the Fock space and introduced there some reasonable interaction causing the decay, and studied how this decaying particle looks from different reference frames. I think in quantum field theory, the same result will be obtained.
Time by some quantum process such as atom clock.
Mm-hmm.
You without that mean that we could not measure time.
Mm-hmm. Yes, because
by quantum process, because they are not.
So what you are saying that, for instance, if we have two different unstable particles, they will, in a moving reference frame, they will decay a little bit differently, right? So if we build our clocks from these two different particles, these clocks will have a little bit different behavior. So there is no like universal, we cannot build a universal clock, right?
Yeah.
Let us discuss it on Thursday. No, the only reason I don't want to do it now because I want to proceed, because it's a very controversial point. And when I start to say you something controversial, you will just kill me here. But I want to prepare you a little bit for what you'll hear. That's the only, I can go ahead and start discussing that, but
Tomorrow.
I want to survive until.
Tomorrow.
Okay.
Can I just one more question? Hopefully about today's talk. You have momentum zero assumption in
yes.
the rest frame.
Yes.
What's the equivalent assumption when you're thinking about the moving particle?
Moving particle, that its momentum is not zero. So. Okay, that was decay law of a particle at rest. And for moving particle, I took initial state with momentum p at time zero, where p is certain, just for convenience, I introduced this. In order to introduce parameter theta in my theory.
That's just
mv. Yes, that's it's not mv. At mv times this factor. So it's
relativistic mass time.
Yes, that's a proper connection between theta, because v is given by hyperbolic tangent of theta and p by sine.
Is that also the action of the momentum generator?
Boost generator.
I beg your pardon.
So that's what I wrote here. Yeah, if you apply non-interacting boost to zero momentum state, you'll get this one.
So you're choosing non-interacting boosts.
Non-interacting because I want my particle to stay in the same subspace HA. So it is just, how to say. It is just mathematical. I could forget about this boost and just plug in this state there. Little bit helpful for me in calculations because here I can use commutation relations between H and K0. It little bit helps with algebra, but it doesn't play any physical role.
Okay, but I mean, perhaps I'm confused here, but if I think of a passive transformation
mm-hmm.
of a particle that's in that subspace HA.
Mm-hmm.
I don't expect a passive transformation to take a state in that subspace to a state in that subspace.
What do you mean passive transformation?
If I'm looking at the same part from the point of view of a moving frame,
yes.
I don't see any reason why it should stay in that subspace.
That's what I try to show here. And I think
that. But then if you go back to the original slide,
mm-hmm.
you can define the moving particle in that subspace that will not be given If you're going to introduce a boost operator.
Yeah, here boost is non-interacting. So boost is guaranteed to work only within this subspace HA, this non-interacting boost. But interacting boost, which you need to use when you transform from one observer to another, interacting boost will move your state vector out of subspace.
So finish here.
Yes.
Thank you.